To introduce this episode of An American Gallery, here is Raymond Massey.
Perhaps no form of literary endeavor has caused more groans among pint-sized he-men-to-be than poetry. The fact that a written concept takes on meter and rhyme still bewilders those of us who insist on calling a spade a spade. However, the work of one poet in particular has withstood the ravages of rebuke by a generation weaned on commercial jingles, rock and roll lyrics, and prurient limericks. For 60 years of the 19th century, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote for the masses. His love for children was evident in most of his work. Today, a century later, most of us know who stands under a spreading chestnut tree. We know that Miles Standish had a most unique courtship, and we know that Hiawatha dwelled near the shores of the Gitche Gumee. But of the man who created these timeless poems, we know little. Here, then, a brief introduction by a few of those who knew him best.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, poet, saluted this week on An American Gallery. Dan O'Herlihy stars as Longfellow.
Mr. Longfellow is my friend. We live on the same street in Cambridge. That's in Massachusetts. But I guess everyone knows that. Just as everyone knows Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Or knows about him. I mean, I really see him and talk to him. Mr. Longfellow is nice to me and all the children. He has 5 of them. There was another one, but it died when it was real little. Mr. Longfellow wrote a poem just about children. I re-memorized it. Ah, what would the world be to us if the children were no more? We should dread the desert behind us worse than the dark before. I saw Mr. Longfellow just the other day. We were both in the waiting room at the dentist's. I had a little toothache. Not a bad one. Mr. Longfellow had taken Alice there. She's one of Mr. Longfellow's daughters. She's a good friend of mine.
Emily, I get the distinct impression you're staring at me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Longfellow. But you look scared, like something hurts you.
Yes, I suppose I do, Emily. My little Alice is in there. And I'm certain I'm suffering far more than she.
My mother told me not to think about it. Going in there, I mean.
Excellent advice. Perhaps we can not think about it together.
We could talk about rabbits or sleds. Kittens, maybe? It's fun talking with you.
I return the compliment. Children are things of joy. Did you know, Emily, I once wrote an ode to children?
No, sir.
1845, 16 years ago.
We're learning the village blacksmith in school now.
Are you?
I have to recite it Friday.
Oh, that doesn't give you too much time.
I know it now, I think.
I'd love to hear it.
Under a spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. The smith, a mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands. And the muscles of his brawny arms are strong as iron bands.
That dentist has brawny arms. Looks more like a blacksmith than a man of tenderness and delicacy. A dentist should be tender and delicate. My poor little Alice. How long does he think I can stand having her in there?
Alice came out a minute later. She was holding her hand by her mouth where it hurt. She wasn't crying, but there was a tear on Mr. Longfellow's cheek as he took her in his arms and held her. Mr. Longfellow said he'd wait for me until the dentist was through because I was alone. I went to his house the next day with a present because he was so nice to me.
Well, Emily, you're all smiles. Tooth feeling better?
Yes, sir, all better.
But not quite well enough for a piece of licorice, do you suppose?
No, sir. Maybe tomorrow?
I shall schedule it. I was just going to read to Alice and Edie. Why don't you join us?
I have to get back to help my mother hang the washing, but I wanted to give you this. It's a present.
What is it?
Jack and the Beanstalk. I noticed you didn't have a copy of it in your library.
How very right you are. I don't. Emily, I will sincerely treasure this addition to my library.
Mr. Longfellow is my friend.
Henry is my husband. We are both New Englanders. Henry was born in 1807 in Portland, Maine. His was a long-established American family of considerable wealth. They were Puritans who had discarded the rigidity of Puritanism. When Henry was 14, he went to Bowdoin College in Maine. In spite of his youth, he was an exceptional scholar. He met his first wife upon his return 3 years later. It was during a second European trip that Mary Potter Longfellow died. You would have to know Henry, love him, to understand how saddened he must have been at her death. When he returned to the United States, Henry began his professorship at Harvard. Some years later, in 1836, we met. It was in Switzerland while Henry was on his third European trip and I was traveling with my family. When we were all back home, Mr. Longfellow's intentions became quite clear.
Miss Appleton, may I call you Fanny? It's not really presumptuous, for I think of you as Fanny all the time.
Perhaps too soon for that.
Too soon? After 6 eternal months?
I'm only 19.
And I'm younger, because I know you.
I've always wanted to learn German.
I shall be your teacher. But it would be false for me to claim I wanted only your company. I want your heart.
Mr. Longfellow, I shall be so sorry to see you leave now. Why did I do that? Perhaps I knew then. Now it's merely a fact. Recalled, but not understood. But Henry, thanks to dear God, was not to be discouraged.
Thou foolish woman, to disdain such love as this.
He would write such things, but never say them. Some years later, after we were married, a friend showed me a letter Henry had written him during the time I made him suffer so by withholding my love.
To tell you the whole truth, I saw in Switzerland and traveled with a fair lady whom I now love passionately and have loved ever since I knew her. As yet, no sign of yielding. As stately and sublime and beautiful as ever, while I likewise sail with the flag nailed to the mast to sink or to conquer. The lady says she will not. I say she shall. It is not pride, but the madness of passion.
2 years later, he began to abandon all hope.
Met the stately lady in the street. I looked and passed, as Dante prescribes on a certain occasion. It is ended.
That I could have been so cruel to one I now love so much. In a later time, Henry remembered it all and put it to paper.
How often, oh, how often in the days that had gone by, I had stood on the bridge at midnight and gazed on that wave and sky. How often, oh, how often I had wished that the ebbing tide would bear me away on its bosom, o'er the ocean wild and wide. For my heart was hot and restless, and my life was full of care, and the burden laid upon me seemed greater than I could bear.
And so it was for 7 years, until an April evening in 1843.
The first song of the crickets.
It's unusually warm for April, Mr. Longfellow.
Do you ever wonder, Fanny, what happens to their song during the winter?
We really should be inside with the others.
Please. Can't we sit here for just a few moments?
My brother leaves for Europe tomorrow. I won't see him for months.
And I may not see you for a day or two. That separation will seem much longer. Please sit. Fanny, I have a confession. I think of you as my dark lady. I don't really know why. Your hair isn't all that dark. Your skin is fair.
Perhaps the unattainable has an ambience of darkness.
Perhaps.
Fanny, it has been 7 years. 7 years! You're no longer a child of 19. You're a woman of 26.
And you are a dear man of infinite patience, Mr. Longfellow.
I feel like Miles Standish in desperate need of a John Alden.
I am no Priscilla, Mr. Longfellow.
Oh, for which I am most thankful. She ended up with Alden, you know.
And Miles Standish said with a smile, I should have remembered the adage, if you will be well served, you must serve yourself. And moreover, no man can gather cherries in Kent at the season of Christmas.
Serve myself, I do. To no avail.
Onward the bridal procession now moved to their new habitation, happy husband and wife, and friends conversing together.
My poetry. And my dream. You flatter me to know my poetry so well.
I have just reread much of it. I suspect I shall be reading much more. I expect to be very lonely with my brother gone. 39 Beacon Street will seem quite different without him.
There's no need for you to be lonely. Not ever.
You must come and comfort me, Mr. Longfellow. On May 10th, 1843, I wrote a note accepting Henry as my betrothed. He was too restless to sit in a carriage, too impatient and fearful of encountering anyone, so he walked to my house, the note still in hand, with the speed of an arrow. He was, as always, the poet.
I had to come at once. I walked amid the blossoms and sunshine and song of birds, with my heart full of gladness and my eyes full of tears. This day will be forever blessed. It ushers in a new life of happiness.
And so on July 13th, 1843, we were married. We lost our third child, but five still live. Our happiness was worth waiting for. Being married to Henry, I feel that I am now fulfilling my destiny upon this earth.
You are today fairer than ever. Each year, an added grace and a new charm in you. And in me, more love and increase of affection. I leave you even for an hour, and the lights seem dimmer, the music sadder, the flowers fewer.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is my husband.
I want to talk about my father, Mr. Longfellow. As a young child, I'm 17 now, though it's said I appear and sound much older, I found far more pleasure chasing after rabbits than I did reading my father's poetry. I remember it coming as something of a surprise when I finally realized that my father was a famous man, and that we were indeed privileged to have the poems of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow read to us by the man himself, while the five of us gathered about to listen. I love my father dearly, always have. But, frankly, I never had much taste for poetry, even his. Until, I was 11, perhaps 12, when suddenly something my father had just written fired my imagination and found me his most attentive listener. He had written about the Indians, one in particular. Before I heard that poem, I fancied that all Indians were alike. Evil, dressed in feathers, mounted on black stallions, sending stinging death through the air. But then I heard my father tell my mother,
Fanny, I believe I finally hit upon a plan for a poem on the American Indians. I'm going to weave together their beautiful traditions into a whole.
Indians? Beautiful traditions? What nonsense was this? But then I heard it. The song of Hiawatha. The song of his wondrous birth and being. How he prayed and how he fasted. How he lived and toiled and suffered that the tribes of men might prosper, that he might advance his people. Father worried about that poem. He was so close to it that he seemed to lose all perspective. I can see him now, reading it to us, one eye on the paper, the other eye on us, seeking our reactions.
By the shores of Gitche'gumee, by the shining big sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis. Dark behind it rose the forest, rose the black and gloomy pine trees, rose the...
Oh, go on, Papa.
You already read that part to us.
My meter's off in the next line. Well, let me go on to a new part. Out of childhood into manhood, now had grown my Hiawatha, skilled in all the craft of hunters, learned in all the lore of old men, in all youthful sports and pastimes, in all manly arts and labors.
It was excitement, adventure, and I found myself imagining I was Hiawatha. Give me of your bark, O birch tree, of your yellow bark, O birch tree, growing by the rushing river, tall and stately in the valley. I, a light canoe, will build me, build a swift chimon for sailing that shall float upon the river like a yellow leaf in autumn, like a yellow water lily. And when Father wrote of Hiawatha fishing, it was as though I were in the canoe beside him. Through the clear, transparent water, he could see the fishes swimming far down in the depths below him. And he wrote of Hiawatha's life, of his longing for Minnehaha, of Hiawatha's wedding, of the happiness he knew in time of peace.
Buried was the bloody hatchet. Buried was the dreadful war club. Buried were all warlike weapons, and the war cry was forgotten. There was peace among the nations.
Well, my mother liked that part. But as Hiawatha said, lo, how all things fade and perish. And there were great conflicts. Full of wrath was Hiawatha when he came into the village, found the people in confusion, heard of all the misdemeanors, all the malice and the mischief of the cunning Pawpakiwis. Hard his breath came through his nostrils. Through his teeth he buzzed and muttered words of anger and resentment, hot and humming like a hornet. Oh, it was like no other poem I had ever read. And I thought about it when the Civil War started a few years later. Perhaps I thought the Song of Hiawatha revealed a side of my father I had never known. A side that would make him understand my desire to fight for the Union.
I'm not sure I heard you, Charlie. Say it again.
I said I want to join the army.
Oh, foolish impetuosity.
I've thought about it a lot.
You were always impetuous.
Papa, it's my duty to do what I can for my country.
You're too young, Charlie. Let's hear no more of this.
I'm no younger than thousands of other men fighting.
Men, men. We become men so soon these days, Charlie. I said I'd hear no more
Papa,
of it.
Papa, watch out, the dog.
Whoa, whoa! You want to go to a war. Ernest wants to climb a mountain in Europe. It all happens too fast, Charlie. Too fast.
I want your approval.
But you'll go either way. Charlie, I think you know I try to have my children make their own decisions.
I know, Papa.
But it's been different with you. You've always been so active, impetuous, skillful in all out-of-door sports, never a lover of schoolbooks, but with a very strong will of your own. It's good to be strong-willed. If there's thought behind your actions.
I have thought. A lot. I'm going.
Charlie, you've already mutilated one hand with a gun.
I was 14.
You say it as though it were a century ago.
Papa, I'm willing to give my other hand. My life for my country. Don't you understand? Enlisting is something I have to do. Could you live without writing?
Could I live without you?
Now your objections are selfish.
After the gun exploded, the one I let you use, and your hand was maimed, I ate my bread with tears. Now you ask this of me. Charlie, your motives are noble, but you're too young. It wouldn't be a disgrace to wait a little longer.
Are you saying no, Papa?
Get up!
Papa?
Youth is impatient. I know that. I should remember it. Ernie will be climbing his mountain sooner than I realize. We've traveled only 3 blocks. How could you enter the carriage a boy and ride to manhood in so short a distance? 3 blocks. We'll turn a corner and my Charlie will be a soldier.
Thank you, Papa. Thank you. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is my father.
I want to talk about my friend and fellow poet, Longfellow. My name is familiar, I trust. Oliver Wendell Holmes. It was my poem, Old Ironsides, that saved the Constitution, the vessel, that is, from being scrapped. Back in 1830, that was. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Why a man needs three names has always puzzled me. One would think there were just dozens of plain Oliver Holmeses standing at every street corner. But if one writes poetry, it seems to be the thing to do. Consider Ralph Waldo Emerson, James Russell Lowell, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I suppose we should regard Walt Whitman as some sort of a rebel. Oh, well, I know them all, of course. Fine men, everyone. But Longfellow, well, I find a singular charm in the society of Longfellow. A soft voice, a sweet and cheerful temper, a receptive rather than aggressive intelligence, the agreeable flavor of scholarship without any pedantic ways, and a perceptible soupçon of humor, although that humor was certainly not evident in his Evangeline, one of my favorites. This is the forest primeval. The murmuring pines and the hemlocks bearded with moss and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, stand like druids of eld with voices sad and prophetic, stand like harpers hoar with beards that rest on their bosoms. Wonderful, wonderful. Hawthorne turned down the story. A true one, incidentally. But Longfellow saw it as excellent material for a poem. So typical of him to use another's story. He never used the tragedy in his own life as a basis for any of his works. And tragedy did stalk him this year. Ironically, he wrote these words in his journal on June 19th last.
If one could only foresee one's fate.
I remember passing the Longfellow home only a few days before the tragedy and thinking how I trembled to look at it. For those who lived there had their happiness so perfect that no change could fail to be for the worse. I learned later what happened on the 9th of July. It was a dreadfully hot day. Fanny was in the library using some hot wax to set Edie's curls.
That's a pretty dress, Mama.
Well, it's cool. If anything can be cool in dreadful heat.
Could I have a dress like that?
We'll see. Hold still now. I'm almost done.
How come so many boys have naturally curly hair when they don't need it?
I don't know, Edie. Hand me another match, would you, dear?
Here.
Now, this is the last curl.
There's a breeze coming through the window.
It's a welcome guest. Oh!
Henry, I feel so helpless.
The doctor put her to sleep with some ether. He has hope. I must have hope, too.
And your face and hands?
Oh, it happened so quickly. In an instant, Oliver. I can't let the children see my grief, my concern. It would make it all the more difficult for them. How do these things happen? What reason? That, of course, is an eternal question.
In the morning, Fanny was able to drink some coffee. But a while later, she fell into a coma. She never awakened. She was buried on July 13th, the 18th anniversary of her wedding to Henry. Henry had been working on Wayside Inn at the time, but the tragedy kept him from returning to it for almost 2 years. Somehow he managed to keep his grief from his children. Even when Charlie was seriously wounded, and Henry spent long months nursing him back to health. Too saddened for original writing, but needing something to turn his thoughts away, he concentrated on his translation of Dante's Divine Comedy. Those of us who loved him knew that the time would come someday when he paid tribute to his beloved wife. So enduring was the pain of her loss that it took him 18 years to write a sonnet to her memory.
In the long, sleepless watches of the night, a gentle face, the face of one long dead, looks at me from the wall, where round its head the night lamp casts a halo of pale light. Here, in this room, she died, and soul more white never through martyrdom of fire was led to its repose. Nor can in books be read the legend of a life more benignant. There is a mountain in the distant west that, sun-defying, in its deep ravines displays a cross of snow upon its side. Such is the cross I wear upon my breast these 18 years. Through all the changing scenes and seasons, changeless since the day she died.
Longfellow, God bless him, is my friend.
In 1882, the pen wrote no longer. Perhaps it didn't have to. The man who put it to paper had already won immortality.
You have been listening to another portrait in an American gallery. Today, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, poet. Starring Dan O'Herlihy as Longfellow. Featured in the cast were Jane Webb, Lillian Bieff, Steve Franken, Mona Lewis, and Marvin Miller. Sound by Gene Twombly. The story was written by Robert M. Young. Produced and directed by William Lally. Art Ballinger speaking.
This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service.